Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Jonathan Weiler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He is the Director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he also writes for the Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Weiler.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Jonathan, why do you think it is that we've been hearing so much in the last couple of days about the Iowa straw poll, with headline coverage of Michelle Bachmann's victory, and she won by 4,823 votes out of about 17,000 cast. Ron Paul came in second, only 152 votes behind her, and yet nobody pays any attention to the fact that he was a virtual tie with Bachmann for first place.
You know, it's been interesting with Ron Paul. Going back to 2008, I'm sure you remember at the end of 2007, he made headlines. He had that one-day money bomb where, you know, he raised like $4.5 million, and all of a sudden he seemed to be a surging challenger. And yet he's always been a marginal figure in the Republican Party. It's almost as if not only the party leadership doesn't know what to do with Ron Paul, but it also seems as if the media doesn't quite know what to do with Ron Paul, because he does fit less easily, I think, into our conservative and liberal categories than other people like Bachmann do. So I think that's at least one reason why he sort of gets ignored. I think people don't know quite what to make of him.
Well, there's also, I think, a tendency in the media to think that he doesn't have a chance of, you know, winning. They didn't think he'd win in Iowa, which he almost did. He won't win the nomination, and he certainly won't win the presidency.
Yeah, no, that is certainly true as well. And you know, I would say until probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, I don't think people would have taken Michelle Bachmann very seriously as a candidate either, although that clearly seems to be changing.
So you were at one of Ron Paul's rallies back in Iowa, that in the last cycle, right, in
08? Yes, I was. I was in Iowa in 2008, and one of the events I went to was a Ron Paul speech. And I have to say, Ian, it was one of the wackiest political events I've ever been to in my life. I mean, the sort of amalgamation of people there, from the 20-something hipsters who like Ron Paul because he favors legalizing medical marijuana, to the guys in their 60s and 70s dressed in military uniforms talking about how the United States has been ignoring the MIAs from Vietnam for 40 years. It was a bizarre gathering, and I think it adds to the point I made a couple of minutes ago, that people just don't quite know what to make of this guy, and it's really hard to sort of pin down what, if any, his base of support is. It just seems to be coming from a lot of very disparate directions.
Well, but, you know, that's one of the questions I have, is how does the libertarian Ron Paul at the same time appeal to both dope-smoking anti-war activists and anti-government gun lovers?
Yeah, and it's a good question. You know, I think part of Ron Paul's appeal, and I'm thinking a little bit about the event I saw that night in Iowa in January 2008. I think part of Ron Paul's appeal is that you do get the sense that what he believes, he's believed for a long time. He didn't just sort of fashion talking points to fit the latest news cycle. And so I do think, and I'm not saying that this is actually true, but I think that there's a sense of his authenticity that appeals to different kinds of people. And I think that's part of why you see him drawing support from sort of unusual and unusually disparate parts of the political spectrum.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Weiler, author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. And, of course, he's a 12-term congressman from Texas, elected as a Republican, even though he is a libertarian and certainly doesn't shy away from that label.
Yeah.
He may be sort of, in a way, sort of exemplifying this paradox in American politics, where the largest political party in America is, in fact, I'm not one of the above.
You're right.
I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. You know, the country's full of recovering Democrats and recovering Republicans. That doesn't mean when you come to election time, they don't go back and vote for Tweedledum and Tweedledee. But
I think that's right. And to sort of amplify that point, Ian, I think that, you know, there's a tendency to, I think especially on the part of the media, to sort of mythologize the independent voter as a particularly sort of thoughtful voter, a voter that doesn't just sort of get sucked in by partisanship and slogans and really sort of takes her time to think about the issues and then settle on the candidate who best represents those. And the reality of independence, you know, for those who aren't obvious partisan leaners, and that is a lot of them, but the reality for independents is that their thinking on politics is really incoherent. It's just sort of all over the map, and it easily sways with sort of the time and the latest news cycle, et cetera. And so in that regard, you know, it makes some sense that a candidate who's really sort of himself, in some ways, all over the map on political issues, but gives voice to a certain kind of authentic American libertarian tradition, would appeal pretty broadly.
But I think the other point is, Jonathan Wyler, is that he runs as a Republican, not as a Libertarian. If he switched parties, he'd be nowhere.
That's right.
And I just talked to some reporters before we went on the air down in Houston to try and get a handle on how he gets reelected all the time. And they say, well, he does great constituent service, even though he's anti-government. He was against hurricane relief because that's big government. You know, they had a big hurricane down there in Galveston.
And he was against swine flu vaccination in 2009 because that was a federal power grab.
Right, but at the same time, they took the hurricane relief money, the district. So it's sort of, to me, is a lesson for the futility, I think, of the third party on the left. You know, you'd be much better off taking over the corrupt shell of the Democratic Party than going off under the banner of the Greens or the Peace and Freedom Party, because you know you'll get nowhere. Just as Ron Paul, is much cleverer to run as a Republican than be run as a Libertarian.
No, that's absolutely true. And you know, we should say too that, despite the fact that Paul takes some positions that are, you know, not consistent with the mainstream of his own party, like he's against the Patriot Act and he's been, you know, very critical of U.S. involvement in Iraq and is generally sort of generally anti-Pentagon posture, that he has been rated by one very respectable rating system the most conservative member of Congress in the last 75 years. So, you know, he really does come by his conservatism quite honestly and unabashedly.
Well, if that conservatism includes smoking dope and being against the Afghan war, I'm not sure it does. But that, if that becomes a Republican issue in terms of not so much the dope, legalizing marijuana, but getting out of these wars, that will be very interesting, don't you think, Jonathan? Particularly in a general election.
Yeah,
imagine
if it was
the Republicans who were anti-war, not the Democrats, because this is Obama's war now.
Yeah.
Even though it was Bush's, and you know, it'd be such a paradox to think that the Democrats become the party of war.
Well, and you know, Ian, we're really sort of being set up for that in a way by this whole super Congress that came out of the debt ceiling deal, right? Because one of the, you know, if the super Congress deadlocks and is unable to agree to $1.5 trillion in additional cuts, then one of the triggers is that there's supposed to be very significant additional cuts in Pentagon spending. And it's people like Leon Panetta and President Obama who have been saying in the last few days that those further cuts are unacceptable, that this super Congress needs to come to a deal so that doesn't happen. But I think you have to be dreaming to think that the Republicans and that super congressional committee or whatever it is would be more likely to agree to increase taxes than to accept those triggered Pentagon cuts. So, you know, I think that when Obama made this deal, he was gambling on the Republican Party being loath to agree to deep cuts in defense spending. And I think at this point, the Republican Party is much more doctrinaire about taxes, for example, very well exemplified, by the way, by Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul, who has himself made lots of statements about the need to cut Pentagon spending because it's contributing too much to our deficit. So I think the Republican Party in that regard, and how tactical it is and on principles, who knows, but in that regard, I think the Republican Party is going to have more interesting conflicts about the size of our Pentagon budget than the Democratic Party is, at least for the next year and a half.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Wyler, author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. Well, I think what you just told us, Jonathan, it was absolutely made clear at that debate that they had in Iowa early in the week, where they were asked if they'd take a 10-to-1 ratio of cuts to revenues, whether they'd find 10-to-1 acceptable, and not one of them did. I mean, they all, you know, I mean, that's shows you how far they've gone in this anti-tax, anti-revenue dogma.
And I suppose, you know, that's if there's one sort of claim to fame, if you will, within the Republican universe that Ron Paul really has, it's that he was sort of the first to this kind of position, right? Because he's been anti-tax and anti-federal spending for years and years and years before this became absolutely unshakable doctrine within the party. So he has been an intellectual leader, if you can call it that, in that regard, in his party.
So do you think that this this peculiar combination of anti-war social laissez-faire on the one hand, and you know, getting rid of Social Security and the more draconian right-wing stuff that clearly give Ron Paul that rating that you said, where he gets the one of the top conservative ratings. Is that likely to attract a younger generation of libertarians? I mean, there's always been people around that somehow find Ayn Rand interesting. But that's a kind of perennial fringe group. But I'm wondering whether there is more and more appeal. Because when Ron Paul asks for money, the money pours in. I mean, he does as good as Obama did back in 2008.
He is an amazing fundraiser, which really speaks to some very impressive intensity of support that he has. But, you know, Ian, about your question, I guess I'm skeptical that these younger generations ultimately are going to go for a candidate like Ron Paul, because I think that in their mind, I think this is, you know, the flip side of Ron Paul being politically savvy enough to know that if he runs as a libertarian, he's completely marginal and irrelevant, and if he runs in the Republican Party, he has some political relevance. The flip side of that is that younger voters, especially voters under 30, I think are so turned off by the Republican Party, and so turned off by, you know, their social conservatism, their intolerance. You know, Ron Paul himself, I know he's denied this, but he has a checkered past when it comes to race, especially in terms of this newsletter that he put out 20 years ago and some of the articles that were written there. And so speaking maybe not necessarily about Ron Paul specifically, but just about that kind of grouping of political positions, it's hard for me to see that somebody in the Republican Party will appeal broadly to voters under 30 who are really developing, as I said, a very strong antipathy to what they perceive as the party's general intolerance, really across the board. And I suppose, you know, moving away from sort of specific social issue positions, I think it's a broader intolerant disposition that's so troublesome to those younger voters. And it just, the Republican Party is just not going to get away from that label for the foreseeable future.
Well, Ron Paul's son, Rand, made that extraordinary statement about why he opposed integration in the South, based upon the intrusion on the business owner who had the cafe that refused to allow blacks in, you know, that somehow by forcing that owner to integrate to his restaurant and to serve everybody that comes in the door, that was somehow infringing on this person's right to do business.
Right, their property rights.
But it was totally devoid of any kind of historical or social or moral understanding of what civil rights was about. So,
well, absolutely. And it should be noted that Rand Paul got in a lot of trouble in early 2010 for making those comments, and, you know, especially about the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And his father, Ron, has the same position. He opposes the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
That won't make him unpopular with racists down in his district, I should think.
Again, in terms of the sort of general tendency to intolerance, as you and I have discussed previously, that's just so pervasive in the Republican Party now that's a label they're not gonna shake.
But it sort of is paradoxical for libertarianism, because libertarianism, I suppose, is ultimately about tolerance, isn't it? I mean,
well, you know, Ian, it's a really interesting question. I was thinking about that a little bit earlier. You know, libertarianism could certainly be coming from different kinds of psychological dispositions. And one could be exactly from what you said, a real laissez-faire, live and let live attitude. But it could also be coming from a place that says the world is a really messy, complicated place, and what we need are much more simple, clear principles to live by. And I think that kind of notion, this desperate need for things to be simpler than they really are, I do think is consistent on some deeper level with a kind of psychological intolerance, an aversion to a melting pot, multicultural society. So at least in some people's minds, it would make sense to me that a libertarian disposition and an intolerant disposition could, in fact, go together.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jonathan Weiler.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Weiler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He's the director of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about why the rich are not empathetic.
Don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Guitars and drive them old trucks. Let them be doctors and lawyers and such. Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. They never stay home and they're always alone.